The views expressed on this podcast are only those of the individuals featured on the show and do not in any way reflect the official policy of the United States government.
You are listening to the Embassy Wealth Podcast. We believe wealth isn't just about finances and money. It includes health, relationships, and anything else that makes you excited to get up in the morning. We interview members of the foreign affairs community to see how they're building wealth, both personally and financially, no matter where they're posted. This is your host, Tanya Salsa. Let's get to today's show. Welcome to the Embassy Wealth Podcast, and I am super excited today to bring our very first famous Foreign Service guest, Sam Dogan, who many of you may have followed over the years, writes a lot about the Foreign Service community. He's also known as the Financial Samurai. He's got the financialsamurai.com blog that he started in 2009, which has grown to an incredible readership of over a million views per month. He's got a biweekly podcast. He just published a Instant Wall Street Journal bestseller book called How to Spend Your Way to Wealth and Freedom, Buy This, Not That. Welcome to the show, Sam.
Thanks so much for having me.
So actually, I mean, we don't normally have famous people on our podcast, but Sam's actually part of the greater Foreign Service community because actually you grew up in the Foreign Service, right? You were born in Manila and were overseas with a bunch of tours with your parents. How was that growing up as a Foreign Service kid?
I thought it was great. Born in Manila and my parents, we were in, where would we go? We went to Osaka, Kobe, Zambia, Malaysia, Taiwan. And it was wonderful. I thought it was the only life I knew, moving around every 2 to 4 years. But it was really great until about middle school. And middle school, when I had to leave Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, to go to the United States, was really sad because I had made some really good friends. I had a girlfriend, and I just had to say goodbye.
In middle school. Nice.
I would say don't leave. Don't move around after middle school. It's just tough for the kids.
But, you know, it all turned out okay, because I think sometimes Foreign Service families, we worry, like, you know, with so much moving, like, how does that impact kids? And obviously, I mean, you have an incredible story, right? So you come back to Northern Virginia as a middle schooler, and you go to McLean High School. High school, right? You're in McLean High School. You're doing all the sort of Foreign Service things. How do you get from that to the next phase? And this, you're this famous personal finance blogger. Like, how does that transition happen?
Well, you know, I went to McLean High School in Northern Virginia, and then I applied to local state schools. Virginia has great schools, UVA, William & Mary, Mary Washington, Virginia Tech. And my sister went to Smith College, which is a private school, and I knew what my parents were making. And we had a humble home, town home, and we had old cars. And I was thinking to myself, how can we afford $22,000 a year in tuition, you know, with me as well? Mm-hmm. And so I decided really very focused to just try to save my parents money and save me money, because I was working also at McDonald's for $4 an hour. So I said, well, if I go to William & Mary, it's only $2,800 in tuition a year versus $22,000 for a comparable private school. Worst case scenario, if I graduate without a job, I can pay my parents back going back to work at McDonald's. And I thought about that I just remember that in junior year, I was like, you know, I can't do this to my parents. And so I've had this kind of pretty focused and frugal mentality ever since I was a kid. And then so I joined Goldman Sachs out of college. And that was kind of like hitting the lottery, because Goldman didn't recruit at William & Mary, but I had gone to a career fair. And the career fair was the start of something like 7 months, 6 rounds, and 55 interviews later.
Crazy.
Goldman Sachs, yeah, in New York City. But from the very first week, I realized I couldn't last long enough because, gosh, you have to get in by 5:30 in the morning. You got to leave after 7, 8 p.m. You're checking your BlackBerry at the time at 9, 10 p.m. for requests overseas. And it was just a really rough time. So I was starting to think about, how do I escape from the very first month?
Wow. I don't think that's the normal post-college job experience, right? Like your first job out of college. Can I ask, why do people in finance work such long hours? I've never understood it. It seems like people make a lot of money, but the sacrifice of just your own personal life and happiness seems pretty high.
Well, the job is really never done. If you think about the ultimate goal in finance, the ultimate goal in finance is to win more business and to make more money. So just like in personal finance, you've got to decide how much is enough because you can always make more money.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, a 40-hour work week is an artificial construct. We kind of scoffed at single-digit work day people when we were in finance.
We're like losers.
It was like only 8 to 9 hours.
Yeah,
it's like that's so funny because you know, once the U.S. markets close and 7 p.m. on the East Coast rolls around, that's 7 a.m. in Hong Kong, and that's when they start.
Stuff so, getting started, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's just a 24-hour cycle. So you have to figure out how much you can push yourself, and then you got to actually, you know, obviously sleep and balance your life. Otherwise, you're going to get burned out.
So you had this experience in finance, which you actually were in for over a decade, right? It was like 12 or 13 years you were in finance. So you survived. You did the grueling rat race piece of it, right? And the, did you save money? Was that kind of your strategy? How did that come about?
Yeah. So, you know, when work is hard, when work is brutal, you logically try to find a way out of work. And so I decided I could last maybe till age 40 and then get the hell out. So I immediately started saying, okay, I'm going to save every other paycheck. So that's two paychecks a month. So one paycheck a month would be saved and 100% of my bonus would be saved and invested. So I could one day generate enough passive income to escape. It was my goal since the very first month. And I feel very blessed to have a really difficult job that really kicked my butt because it made me think about the future. Now, if I had an 8 to 9 to 5 job, it was really cordial and relaxing, I'd probably still be working for 30 years, which would also be fine. But I think I would also get bored because I think after 10 years of doing one thing, I get bored. And I don't know about y'all, but I think I would say most people get bored after 10 years.
I'm right there with you. Uh-huh. And you mentioned you were saving half your income. So 50% of your income on a New York City salary, which I mean, in finance is probably above average, I would guess, for, you know, what most people are making. But I mean, you did a lot of things in an expensive city to save money. And I think this is, you know, useful for a lot of our listeners who come back to DC. And the question is always, how am I going to make it? Because living in expensive cities is by definition, very costly. So how did you make that work?
Well, so, you know, I lived in a studio apartment for the first 2 years because that was all I could afford, but I couldn't even afford it because in New York City, you have to make 40 times the monthly rent. And my base salary was $40,000 in Manhattan, which translates to about $22,000 if you lived in Dallas, Texas. So it wasn't a lot. And so I just had shacked up with a friend in a studio for 2 years. And then when I went to San Francisco in 2001, we rented a 2-bedroom, 1-bath, and I had 2 roommates as well. And it was actually cheaper. So it was just about saving, because I knew the math was if you save 50% of your income, every year you work was 1 year of freedom you bought. So one of my philosophies that I share in Buy This, Not That, and on Financial Samurai is if the amount of money you're saving each month doesn't hurt, you're not saving enough. Mm. And what I mean by that is I don't want people to just wing it with their finances, not be intentional, because if you wing it with your finances 5 to 10 years from now, you're going to wake up and wonder where all your money went. And if you save until it hurts, it means you're actually having to force yourself to think consciously about how much you're saving and what are the expenses that you need to tone down so that you can adjust to hit that saving rate and just keep on going. If you've ever had braces, it hurts because it means that something is moving and something is changing and improving. So with your savings, if it's hurting a little bit, it means you're doing the right thing.
And you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that because I think one of the things that I really liked about your book is, you know, and I think it's there in the subtitle, how to spend your way to wealth and freedom, right? And I think one of the really interesting parts of your book is that you talk about spending and the choices that people make, right? Because I think in life, I mean, a lot of stuff comes at you every day. And I think the average person has a lot of decision points that they make about, do I invest in my 401k or do I put that money in a house? Do I do this or that, right? Kind of in your book, you talk about a lot about choices and how you spend your way to freedom. So talk to me a little bit about that conundrum, because on the one hand, you're saying you really got to save until it hurts. But on the other hand, I think you have a very interesting philosophy about how to spend money to get towards what you want. How do you balance those two things?
Right. So the spending part, the budgeting part is the default setting that you've got to figure down pat, right? That is something that is actually in the background. you figure that out, hopefully sooner, very soon, so that you don't even really have to think about it. You decide, I want to max out all my tax advantage accounts and save 20% after that, or 50%, whatever it is your ultimate target is. My ultimate target was to do at least 50% after mm-hmm. maxing out my 401k. And I got it up higher as my income grew, and then adjusted it accordingly. But once you get that defense part down, it's really about offense to build wealth. The offense part is, I would think, about 90%+ of wealth building. And the reason why I think a lot of personal finance writers or book authors don't talk more about the offense side is ironically because not many of them have finance backgrounds. If you think about, like, if you look at all the personal finance sites out there, most don't come from finance backgrounds. And so it's very hard to talk about the offense side as well. And if you do talk about it, it might really kind of put people off, or it might feel too hard, or it might be too complicated. So my goal was to really focus on the offense part of the equation, because that's where real wealth can be built. Income is unlimited. The upside is unlimited. And so by spending your way to wealth and freedom, it changes your mindset to focus on offense, to focus on strategically investing in optimal choices. And so I have a mantra that I want to share with people, and that is to think in probabilities and not absolutes. And if you think in probabilities, you receive more opportunity. You don't miss out on opportunities. If you only think in absolutes, it means you need 100% certainty to be able to make a choice. And as a result, you might have analysis paralysis, or you might not make those decisions. And so I use a 70-30 decision-making framework, where it states that if you believe there's a 70% chance or greater you're going to make the right choice, go for it. Go for it with great vigor, while having the humility knowing that 30% of the time you're going to get it wrong, but that's okay because you're going to learn from your mistakes and get better over time.
And in a foreign service context, I mean, I think, you know, for the average person, when you say save 50% of your income, it sounds very, very aggressive. But obviously for foreign service people who are overseas and don't have a lot of the expenses that someone living in the United States would, for example, that is possible, right? So I think the foreign service officer and their families, they can get to a point where they are saving that kind of money. So they get out of that defense mode, right? And they're mm-hmm. in that offense mode. They've got extra money to invest. What kinds of things would you suggest that they focus on? I mean, you know, let's say the average person is making somewhere between, I don't know, 75 to 135, right? Mm-hmm. 135,000 a year. Maybe they're on one income with a family, right? You know, they're maybe coming back to DC. They've got 100 or 200K in the bank, or even maybe 50,000. In that kind of situation, what would you suggest? Where would you suggest people invest their money? Should they go with stocks? Should they buy real estate? You know, what would you suggest?
It's a very complicated question that many, many people pay lots of money to get long advice from a financial advisor, because everybody's
true.
Different.
True.
So I would say one is to focus on top down, can you save one paycheck? I mean, if you're in the foreign service, I'm assuming like the first, what, $100,000 is tax-free. There's like a tax exclusion amount. That's pretty attractive. See if you can save one paycheck. And that is the discipline first. And then in terms of investing, you want to start small. But I think the easiest path is obviously dividend stocks or the S&P 500. That's the easiest way to automatically credit your investment account every single paycheck, every single month, a percentage of your saving rate, right? So if you save 20%, just keep on doing that. And over time, you're going to see that money grow, and you're going to surprise yourself after 5-10 years. What I do really believe in is getting neutral real estate. So if you come back from the foreign service to America, you want to look into the future and be neutral real estate. Neutral real estate means owning your own property. It's not long, it's not short. You're neutral, you're going up and down with the market, because inflation is too powerful of a force to overcome. You're short the real estate market if you're a renter. And the reason why is because you're at the mercy of ever-rising rents and property prices in general. So just like how shorting the S&P 500 over the past 70, 80 years isn't a wise move, you probably don't want to short the real estate market by renting over that time period. You want to ride that inflation wave. And then finally, you want to go long real estate by owning more than one property, because that's how you can actually benefit, by renting out the place or selling that place for a profit. So in the book, Buy This, Not That, I structure a framework by age in terms of a net worth asset allocation by age. And I do recommend by around 30 or 35, you get neutral real estate. And then you can see by age where I recommend you allocate your net worth, your cash flow, to various assets, including stocks, bonds, real estate, and alternative assets.
And, you know, that's actually one thing I really love about your book, because a lot of, you know, finance books, they're so broad and aspirational, like, yes, you can have financial freedom. You know, you just need to save and do these things. And it's very vague about breaking down the details and the actual numbers. Like, so for example, in my real estate office right now, we're passing around Rich Dad, Poor Dad, because our transaction coordinator is looking at buying her first place, and she wants to budget. And we said, well, read this book. And she comes back and she says, you know, the book was great, but... You know, he was doing all these things, and then he just went to owning all this real estate, and there was all this stuff in the middle missing. Yeah. And I think in your book is actually a prescription for how to do it at each age and stage, conservative, not so conservative, a little more aggressive. You have a lot of very detailed options in your book so that people can create their own wealth plan, which I think is one of the really wonderful things about this book, because you don't get that level of detail in most personal finance books.
Well, thank you. It was intentional, because I've read every single personal finance book since high school, and also to do research for my own book. And there's a balance. It's interesting as a writer and as a publisher. So the publisher want something that's easily consumable, mm-hmm. that's kind of like candy, that tastes good but doesn't really do anything good for you. And so you got to have some kind of hook. So Rich Dad, Poor Dad, cash flow quadrants, whatever. It sounds easy. So then after you finish reading it, you're like, oh yeah, I can do it. But then you realize if you go dig deeper, you don't know how to do it, because exactly. The book doesn't share with you how to think and how to actually transact. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to fill that hole. And that's a risk, you know, because I wrote a very pretty meaty book. It's 110,000 words, whereas the average book is more like 70, 80,000. And I really wanted to go deep into teaching readers how to get there, how to achieve financial independence in a risk-appropriate manner, how to analyze real estate, how to think about the stock market, and so forth. And that could turn people off, because it takes more work to read and to digest and to understand. So it's a really tricky balance that I hopefully it'll work out, because at the end of the day, money is too important to be left up to candy and pontification.
Completely. I appreciated it. And I think a lot of people in the Foreign Service will too, because the Foreign Service tends to be detail oriented. We tend to look at things and really examine the meanings behind them. And so I think a lot of our listeners will find this book very, very enlightening and instructional, because again, I really liked how, you know, in each of the examples that you have here, you have like, if you're in your 20s, in your 30s, 40s, 50s. So in a way, even though you're not a financial advisor per se, right, you have a lot of really good meaty things for people to think about and decide, am I conservative? Do I want to, you know, push the envelope? And I think reading the book and, you know, going through the examples, I feel like at the end of the day, the important thing is to take action, right?
Yes.
To take action. And, you know, I like your 70-30 principle, which is it doesn't have to be perfect. You don't need to have 100% of the information, which, being government employees, we tend to be a little conservative and say, yeah, well, if I don't have all the information, I don't want to act, right? Which right. is our natural tendency. But as you're making the argument, and I agree, if you don't, you miss out on so many opportunities along the way.
Yeah, absolutely. The fear in our heads is often way worse than the reality. And, you know, you should ask yourself, what's the worst that can happen? You know, you ask someone out, they say no, and you feel bad for a little bit, and then you just move on. You try your startup and it fails, then you go get back and get a day job. I launched Financial Samurai. Nobody comes to read. It's okay. It only costs, well, at that time, it cost $500 to launch because I didn't know what I was doing. But now you can launch a website in for free or for less than 50 bucks. The book, I didn't want to write the book because I knew it takes so much work. I wrote my first book.
It's like having a baby. It's like 2 years. It's like a 2 years of having a baby.
Yeah, 2 years editing, marketing. But I told myself, look, will I regret not having taken this opportunity to write with Portfolio Penguin Random House in 10, 20 years when someone asks, what did you do during the pandemic times? I'm going to say, I took care of my daughter, who was born at the end of 2019, and my son, who was 3 years old at the start of the pandemic. And I wrote a book. I wanted to make some lemonade out of a bad situation. And that's also one of the core principles of a financial samurai.
My hat is off to you that you wrote a book while having small children at home during the pandemic. I mean, that is like superhuman stuff there. For all the parents with small children that had to do that, I mean, I don't know how you had any brain cells at the end of the day, but.
Team effort.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, no, I mean, because the book is really something, right? I mean, the details and the analysis that you go into, and I mean, I can tell that it took a lot of thought to like work out the models so that, you know, people reading it aren't like, huh? Because it's very clear, right? And like, even for example, for those of you who are single FSOs coming back to DC, there's a budget there of, you know, kind of, he breaks down what should you invest in your, you know, TSP or Roth IRA or whatever, and then a budget of like what you can spend. And there is a way to do that. Also have maybe a side hustle to boost income. There's lots of different things in the book that you can pick and choose what works for you. And all of it works. You got to do something, right?
Yeah. You got to take action, because I don't want you to look back as an old woman or an old man filled with regret. That's the worst.
And let me ask you, Sam, so your story, so you go to Goldman Sachs, you're putting in all the slave hours, right? Like, you're living at your computer. It's stressful. It's not great for your health. You're determined in this very extreme environment that you're like, there is something better, right? And you leave, and I think you started Financial Samurai prior to leaving, correct? Was that part of your plan, or how did that come about?
Well, I went to business school part-time at Berkeley from 2003 to 2006. And when I graduated in 2006, I was like, oh, I should start a business. But then I was like, nah, I worked, you know, too hard, and I need to pay back my employers who paid for most of my education. So nice. I really focused on my job. But it was only when the global financial crisis hit in 2008 that I said, you know what? I should probably have a backup plan, mm-hmm. and I should probably find some therapy to deal with all the destruction and loss in my finances that took 10 years to build. Because I lost about 35, maybe 40% of my net worth in 6 months. That took 10 years. Yeah, 10 years to accumulate. And so I started Financial Samurai in July 2009, which was literally the bottom of the global financial crisis. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of like good therapy. You were writing, you were connecting. I was connecting with other people who had also gone through loss. And it felt wonderful. And so I kept on writing and writing until I realized about two and a half years later in Santorini, Greece, that maybe there was a life after finance, because I had been contacted by an advertiser in London while I was taking a break at a bar at the top of Santorini overlooking the crater. And he said, I would like to pay you $1,000 to put up an advertising link on your homepage. Are you down? And I said, that sounds pretty good. Let me see if I can do it.
Yes.
And so I was drinking an €8 Mythos beer, and it was so expensive, but I was like, whatever, I'm only in Santorini once. And I said, okay, let me check it out. So I put the link up in like 15 minutes on my phone, which was pretty cool at the time because it had Wi-Fi. And then he PayPal'd me $1,000 within 30 minutes. And I was thinking to myself,
like,
wow, that's
like,
pretty cool.
2 minutes worth of work. Like, oh, maybe this could be something.
Yeah. So that was when I was like, you know what? I think I have a life after finance. Let me just think about how to get out with my severance, with all my stock, deferred stock and cash intact. And so I figured it out. I figured it out by negotiating a severance package. And so that's another thing that I hope people, readers, and everyone think, and that is that there's a better solution to difficult problems. You just have to work things out. There's a mm-hmm. more optimal solution.
And what I love about that story in Santorini is that, you know, the advertiser contacting you, that would not have happened if you had not put yourself out there, right? I mean, like you said, when you started, you didn't know what you were doing, and you just were like, okay, well, I'm just going to start this thing and see what happens, right? You took a chance. You were like, I'm just going to put myself out there. I went through this thing. Maybe other people are going through this thing too. You didn't know what was going to happen. And you're like, well, I'm going to try something new. I'm going to take action. I'm going to, you know, and then the guy calling you, I mean, you put yourself in the range of opportunity, right? Because if nobody knows about you, if you're not doing anything, people are kind of like, well, they just don't know, right, to contact you. And that kind of led to, you know, I think more and more opportunities, right?
Yeah, you never really know what will happen unless you try. And the thing is, I think too many people either don't try or they don't try long enough until they see the flowers bloom. And so with Financial Samurai, it was only until about year two where things started clicking a little bit. I was profiled in the Los Angeles Times.
Ooh.
And I was like, oh, cool, Los Angeles Times. And then once you get, you know, profiled by one legitimate publication, other people
all of a sudden
are
you're
like,
legit. Yeah. You've
oh,
got
okay.
cred.
Oh, yeah. It's like, okay, let's, I guess he's legit. So let's profile you in the Washington Post or whatever. And then it just kind of builds from there. And so it just takes time. But if you can do something that you really enjoy, what a blessing. You know, I've been writing 3 posts a week, every week since July 2009 without fail. And it's just like breathing now. It's like if you can breathe forever, you can write forever.
Do you ever run out of topics to talk about?
No.
Do you ever wake up one day and you're kind of like, I don't have anything to say today?
There's too much to write about. I have to throttle my ideas, otherwise I burn myself out. I mean, if you just scroll on your Twitter feed, for example, there's like 100 things every single day to talk about. So there's never a dull moment. I mean, tomorrow I'm probably going to publish about my thoughts on the student loan debt forgiveness. And not
that's
so
a
much
whole thing. Yes.
Yeah. So not so much, you know, whether it's right or wrong, but what does that mean for the ideal income to live a wonderful middle-class lifestyle where you can garner all the benefits of the government, because the government, the people, they want to stay in power. So they need to, you know, attract you, the middle class. And what is that ideal income based on what the government uses as the income threshold to receive student loan debt forgiveness? So I try to think about derivative ideas on very common topics, and it's really, really fun.
I can imagine. And I mean, you know, you just having the discipline to publish, but then also, you know, you produce a podcast as well, right? I mean, you're on biweekly, is it?
Yeah, a couple times a week. And it's not a hard podcast. It's just me recording into my iPhone. Because I don't know how to set up the software to interview people and then record and then upload. So I'm just literally, I've recorded podcasts in my hot tub during the pandemic. And just get it out there.
And that's the thing too, because I mean, when I started, I mean, I didn't know what I was doing either. And it was, you know, you have to love your listeners because they give you feedback and they're like, hey, maybe you should do this. I'm like, you know what? That's actually a really good idea. So, but again, yeah. If you don't start, you never get anywhere, right? And when I started, I was not very good. And I don't know if I'm any good now, but it's okay because there's still people that, you know, appreciate what you put out, and you just have to do it, right? And I think people have to sometimes get over the fear of, oh, it's not going to work out. And like you said, like, what's the worst that can happen?
But you'll figure it out.
maybe my mom will listen or something, right? But
right.
I mean, in your case, I mean, over a million views of your webpage a month. That's insane. What does that feel like?
It feels pretty cool. But it's taken 13 years. And it's been like that for many years now, maybe 4 or 5 years. So you kind of get used to it too. You're like, oh, whatever. It is what it is.
People listen or read. It's nothing.
Yeah. But what's most exciting is to hear reader feedback from the comments who share their perspectives about something you're talking about. Because at the end of the day, a writer writes because he or she wants to be read.
Mm-hmm.
It's not because we want to make a lot of money. If you want to make a lot of money, don't write a book.
Yeah, completely.
Yeah, but if you want to be read and if you want to have a really cool discussion with other people going through similar things or thinking about things, I think it's really fun.
I would agree. And, you know, I think with your book and your podcast and all of these things, you know, lots of people talk about financial freedom. Mm-hmm. What they don't often talk about is what happens once you get there. Because for a lot of people, they're always chasing the next thing, right? I'm going to climb the next mountain or the next mountain. And financial freedom seems like this big, huge Everest of a thing for a lot of people. What happens once you get there?
Yeah. Well, the funny thing about, I think I helped kickstart the modern day financial independence movement in 2009, but I don't think I get much credit. And one of the reasons why is because I'm not out there so much. And then two, I don't keep writing about financial freedom or financial independence, how to get there and all that stuff. Because what happens is once you achieve your level of financial freedom or independence, you end up moving on with your life and doing normal things. You just talk about your life and you tackle these challenges, which is why Buy This, Not That was so important to me, because I try to face a lot of life's biggest dilemmas, you know, such as should I marry for love or money? Should I send my kids to private or public school? Should I join a startup or an established firm? So many of these dilemmas we face, it's way beyond financial independence. It's like you can be on your journey or you can be after that journey. But the thing is, you're going to face these challenges, and that's what I want to talk about. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about life and how to utilize money to live a better life, not talk about how money is the end game. And that is what would happen if I just talked about financial independence, you know, how to get there.
Agree, because money is a conduit, right? It is not the end goal. It's something that can make your life better or not so great, right? I think it just makes you more of who you already are, right? And I think there's some interesting sort of philosophical questions that when you get to that point, you're kind of like, oh, I got here. Now what? Did you have that experience? I know I did, because I was like, oh, I'm like you. I was in a position where I was like, I do not want someone to tell me that I have to be from, you know, 8 to 5 with my butt in this chair, thinking about these things, renting my brain. I don't want to do it anymore. Right. And so I was hell bent on getting out of that cycle, you know, being financially free. And, you know, I have my own journey and, you know, listeners have heard a little bit about it. But when you get to that point, you think, oh, everything is going to be like, I don't know, rainbows and unicorns or something. And for me, that I was kind of like, oh, I got here and it doesn't look all that different other than I don't have to do that thing that I didn't want anymore. So now I have this, like, how do I create the rest of it, right? Because I think a lot of people, they get sucked into this financially free, I'm going to do this. And then I think sometimes they don't even think about what do they want to do afterwards. And so it sounds like for you, that didn't quite happen because you already had things you were really interested in and you just kept doing more of that. Is that sort of how it came about or?
Well, yeah, I had Financial Samurai, right? 3 years before I left work. So I really loved writing on Financial Samurai. So I was going to fake retire to something that I really loved to do, which was to write. And whether it made money or not, it didn't really matter because I had developed a passive income portfolio at the time in 2012 that generated about $80,000 a year. And so I knew I wouldn't starve. I wouldn't, you know, be thrown on the streets. And also my wife, who is 3 years younger than me, I said, you too can leave your day job by 35, but let me go first. Let me test it out, see how it's going. So it was like a one leg in and out. And then in 2015, things were working out. So she also engineered her layoff by negotiating a severance. So for the first year, it was kind of amazing because even though our income dropped by 80%, maybe more, we had so much freedom so we could do what we wanted and we were happier. We were happier even though we made so much less. But after about a year, you know, there's only so many European Gothic churches you can see before they all start looking the same. Right? They all start looking the same. And I lived in Southeast Asia, so we didn't have that, oh, Thailand.
Gotta travel, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we did travel for, we went to another 20 countries over the next year.
Nice.
And then we were tired. We were like, yeah, we've seen a lot. What else is there? And so I really said, you know, I didn't tell anybody I was retired because that sounded ridiculous at 35. I just said, I'm a writer.
I wouldn't believe you.
Yeah. And then I decided to pivot into, consulting at, you know, seed stage startups because I was in San Francisco. I always wanted to experience what the startup life was like. And then I also coached high school tennis for 3 years. And I thought that was really fun too for three months a year. Yeah. Uh-huh. So just doing what you want and try to scratch those itches and not look back and say, oh, I didn't try.
Completely. And I mean, I think sometimes, at least for the Foreign Service community and a lot of our listeners, they think, oh, that seems so far away. And actually, and I mean, part of the goal of the podcast is it isn't really. I mean, if you make the plan and you follow the steps, and honestly, I think one of the other things you can get from your book is do the math, right? I mean, because it all comes down to a number. And I think sometimes people, they get very like in that analysis paralysis stage because they're like, I don't know what my number is. And you actually have a very specific way of breaking down retirement, for example, of like the numbers that you need, right? Can you talk to us a little bit about, you know, kind of what somebody's number should be like when they're thinking about retirement?
Yeah. So the common rule is the 25 times expense rule. And that's the inverse of the 4% rule, which was created in the 1990s. So I don't recommend anybody follow many things from the 1990s because the world was different then. Back in the 1990s, the 10-year bond yield, which is the risk-free rate of return, was at 5 to 6%. That means you could get a risk-free return on your money at 5 to 6%. So of course, if you drew at a 4% rate of return, you're not going to run out of money. But today, the 10-year bond yield is at 3%. It was as low as 0.52% in 2020. So things are different now, and I recommend a lower safe withdrawal rate, which I talk about in Buy This, Not That, which is the Financial Samurai safe withdrawal rate. And the idea is to take 80% of the latest 10-year bond yield and use that as the safe withdrawal rate for the first 2 years post retirement. But in terms of what amount to get to, I'm not a big subscriber of the 25 times expenses, annual expenses rule to get to your net worth goal, because you can cheat your way to financial independence if you use expenses. You can suddenly say, I'm going to eat just ramen noodles and drink water and cut your expenses down to, let's say, $10,000 a year, maybe. Mm-hmm. And then so 25 times that is $250,000. It's not enough, I don't think. So instead, I use a multiple of income rule. Mm-hmm. So the ideal number, so if you're like just totally hitting it out of the park, is 20 times your annual gross income. Mm-hmm. But I think once you achieve about 10 times your annual gross income, you're going to start feeling really financially free. And then you want to keep on going. You want to keep on saving, keep on investing as your income grows, which is the truth for most Foreign Service officers, right? Because you guys have that income scale. And so 10 to 20 times your gross household income is your net worth goal. And once you get there, I feel you can do whatever you want.
So if someone's making $100,000 a year, right? So you're saying that they should have...
1 to 2 million.
1 to 2 million. Okay. And then if they want to add like their spouse's income, then obviously they can just multiply it by that 25 times rule, right?
Of their also, gross income. Yeah. I mean, so household income, right? So if the, mm-hmm. if the spouse makes $80,000 plus your $100,000, that's 180, 1.8, to double that, 3.6.
I like that math. It's a little easier to wrap your head around because I feel like expenses, I don't know about the rest of you, but I don't honestly, like sometimes I spend more, sometimes I spend less, and I don't know what I'm going to be spending 1 year over another because maybe I take up a hobby 1 year that's kind of expensive and maybe another year I don't, right? So I agree with you that like expenses is a little bit slippery, like a fish. You're trying to grab it and you're like, it's not exactly the, you know, the right number. But I think income, everybody knows what they make on an annual basis. And I think it's easy to calculate from there.
Yeah. And it keeps you honest as you make more income, because I know plenty of people, we've all heard plenty of stories of people making lots of money and not ending up with anything.
True.
Because so income, I think is again, going on the offense, mm-hmm. thinking about an offensive mindset to building wealth.
And what would you say to those people who would say, you know, oh, well, you were in finance and that's really highly paid. And of course, when you were 35 and you got laid off, you had $80,000 in passive income. Well, I'm a government employee and I don't make that kind of money. You know, there's no way I could get to $80,000 a year in passive income. What would you say to those people?
So I say one, I don't know, making $40,000 in Manhattan wasn't a lot of money. I got it. I lived in a studio with another fella for 2 years. And then two, I have to encourage you to have a abundance mindset, a strong money mindset. Don't look at so much the numbers, look at the percentages. Because if you have $100,000 income as a Foreign Service officer, by definition, you are living off $100,000 or less, right? It's just you are living off whatever your income is. And it's all about percentages. Yes, if you're living close to the federal poverty level limit, that's going to be very difficult. But none of y'all are, because you're all Foreign Service officers. So think in percentages, not absolute numbers, mm-hmm. because once you start thinking absolute numbers, your mind kind of goes haywire, where you're like, oh, that person makes $1 million a year. I can never get there. But again, think in percentages. What is 20% of your income? What is 20% of theirs? Because people who make more money have a propensity to spend more money as well.
True.
It's not just, oh, you make a lot, you have it easy street. You also got to think about how much they work, how much taxes they pay, you know, their expenses in a higher cost of living area. I mean, obviously San Francisco and New York City is way more expensive than Kuala Lumpur or Bangkok, right? So helping you think in percentages helps you get rid of all this distortion that you see in these numbers without any perspective or background.
Agree completely. I mean, I think that's a really good point for people to concentrate on those percentages, right? And because I think you can always find somebody that is making more money than you, who has more than you, that it's never ending, right? And so I think if you compare yourself to others' situation, then you that doesn't give you any room to look at your own situation and say, how can I improve here? But if you look at it from a percentage you know, aspect, I think that's where you can really start to see, okay, well, I can allocate this to that thing and then slowly grow it, or, you know, grow it more aggressively.
Yes, absolutely.
Awesome. Well, there you have it. How to spend your way to wealth and freedom by this, not that, with the Financial Samurai. Sam, thank you so much for being on our show. It's great to see that there is life after being a Foreign Service kid, and all those parents out there, you know, we're not ruining our children by like taking them to a bazillion countries. There is hope. So thanks so much for being on the show, Sam.
No worries. Yeah, it was fun. And would I do it with my own kids? I think I would, because now you know, like being a Foreign Service parent, but I know it's impossible to become a Foreign Service officer because the interview and the exam is so difficult, right? Isn't it still less than 3% people get in?
Oh, I don't know what the percentage is nowadays, but yeah, it's still very few people that make it.
That's like impossible. So I've given up on that hope already. So good job, you guys, getting into the Foreign Service, because it literally seems impossible to get into.
And, you know, I think you've got a pretty good life in San Francisco with your blog. And I think we'll continue to read your posts and definitely check out his book, because there's a lot of great information in there and some good examples. And thanks again, Sam.
No worries. And if you want to connect, you can go to financialsamurai.com/news. And if there's no show notes on the book, you can go to financialsamurai.com/BTNT to pick up the book.
Fantastic.
All right. Take care.
If you like this episode and want more, make sure to give us 5 stars on the podcast player of your choice. And after that, check out our Facebook page. From there, you can learn about our other episodes, connect with our guests, and of course, share your own ideas for success. We'll see you next time.